Greetings and blessings to you, listeners. My name is Sunshine Trisseter, and I am bringing you the Pagan Perspectives podcast. I am journeying around the world, and as I do, I am calling together the voices of the pagan community. So make yourself a cup of tea and come and join us for an inspirational sharing of pagan voices.
There's a song that heals the breath, and a song that heals the mind. There's a song that heals our bodies, and it's with us all the time. There's a song that speaks the name of the Holy One without doubt or shame. There's a song that calls us home in that sacred name. There's a song that heals the breath. There's a song that heals the mind. There's a song that heals our bodies, and it's with us all the time. There's a song that speaks of freedom, of loveliness and light. There's a song that sings inside us as we're learning to take flight. We're learning to take flight. There's a song that heals the breath, and a song that heals the mind. There's a song that heals our bodies, and it's with us all the time. There's a song that speaks the name of the Holy One without doubt or shame. There's a song that calls us home in that sacred name. Oh, no, ya ba ya bo bo, ya ba ya bo bo, bo ya bo bo ya da yo, bo ya bo ya do ya do ya, bo ya da ya do ya, da da ya bo ya da.
Song was by the Alexa Sunshine Rose. Check out all of her links for her music in the episode description. And now let us go on with our interview with Shivam O'Brien. And I am sitting here in Ireland with my friend Shivam O'Brien. Now, you have heard his voice here before. He is, how do I describe you? You're a bard storyteller. You're amazing with instruments, but you're also a community builder and a teacher. You have your amazing rewilding retreat center, Spirit Horse, in the wilds of Wales. So I welcome you once again, Shivam.
Thank you so much. Nice to be here again. After all my ramblings last time, I'll try and say something to the point this time. Good morning, everybody, or good evening and afternoon, wherever this gets heard. Greetings from the west of Ireland. The summer has just passed, and we are here when the first leaves are beginning to fall in my backyard there. And it's been a pleasure to see this abundant summer, but time is passing. You can feel autumn is approaching. Here we are. Shall we make a little prayer? Is that what you would like to start?
Yes, would you create the sacred space cauldron that we are in?
Yeah, perhaps can't create anything, but we can praise what is. sitting quietly there a few minutes ago, the leaves rustling in the wind, the tops of the forest. This is eternal. The seasons change. The fullness of summer is beginning to turn golden and brown. This is timeless. The leaves will fall back to the earth. This is always happening. What jumps up falls down. The whole movement of life is around us everywhere. From the great ancestor fire, there came the ashes where we live on earth. From our mother, the waters, there came this green springing life. From this marriage we are born, and all air is the breathing of one thing into another, one thing becoming another, one thing melting into another, one thing giving life to another. For all of the breaths, for all of the many airs of our planet, for the spark, for the wetness, for the cool, for the warmth, for all that these bodies made from this timeless explosion, made from these stars, these new earths, for all that makes us, the speakers, the noisy ones of the planet. The great intelligence has borne, it seems, a voice with which to praise, to make words, and to gather together all that has been into a story. Humans make many stories. We could start there, if you like.
Here, present in this moment with you, ready to receive these stories.
So I was, because of our little chats over the last couple of days, I thought it would be kind of nice to say something about story. And especially as yourself and your listeners seem keen to explore the pagan route, we could start there a little bit. But I don't have any theory of story or anything else. Maybe with Talastor at the end, if there's time, if I don't ramble on too much. And but to talk a little bit about the significance of story, especially for people, all you dear listeners, who perhaps are interested in finding the roots of a culture, or maybe rekindling a fire, or putting kind of fresh juice into some ancient dried root of where we came from. And we can see, of course, no one needs to hear this, but that the world is in all kinds of crisis, and many people are looking for the eternal, the timeless, the root, the truth, the place that we were sprung from, how to heal the world, what have we lost, what wrong track have we gone on? How do we get on this train that's kind of, you know, hurtling in one particular direction? And I think everybody knows there's something wrong, but it takes a lot of not thinking, not probing, and not statistics, but a lot of deep searching to find out how have we ended up like this? Where have we gone wrong? And one of the, what's the word? One of the sort of sharp instructors that came to me when I first started to work with community, first set up Spirit Horse 30 years ago, and was that we would need to tell stories. I didn't know why, and I still don't really know why. It just came to me, we need to tell stories, and that is how we might be able to begin to look at things differently, speak about things differently, and start a new kind of culture, even if it was just going to be a culture in our own little teepee village or our little Celtic roundhouse village. And there would be some kind of new language. But not even that was like a secondary thought. It was just like, I just heard this story from ancient Ireland. I think we should tell it. I just heard this story that these people that live in the northwest of America tell, and I think we should tell that. And there was one story from the northeast, and three or four stories came along. And I thought, these are going to be important. And I didn't want to set myself up as some kind of teacher guru. I think I've avoided that all these years. But I did think I could tell stories. And the stories will undoubtedly be wiser than me. Now, that was a really good hunch. And There was one good thought I ever had, that was it. And it turned out to be that, the stories knew a lot more than me, and they knew a lot more about me than I knew about them. And us humans, the singers and speakers, you know, that Earth has blossomed into, find ourselves, if we're looking for the holy way, we find ourselves praising and using language. We find ourselves telling the story of the world, but in multifarious ways. There isn't like just one way of telling it. There isn't one fundamental story that explains everything. But there's this endless, diverse mix of languages and cultures and climates, but nevertheless, the same deep themes arise. How do we come here? How did the world reach a shape? And what stories do we need to know to guide the culture? Now, in many ways, our culture's off the rails. In many ways, culture is story. It is the story that's embedded in the culture. And the whole of Europe and everybody that's had anything to do with Europe has been affected by the blindness of the interpretations of the Bible and by the fundamentalist religions who all want to annihilate each other. I'm not going to sort of mince words here. It's fairly obvious. I don't have any particular argument about that. I just want to go deeper than that. I spent a lot of time in the East with Tibetan Buddhists and other kinds of Buddhists, and with the vast psychic magnificence of what's called Hinduism, which is just means anything that goes on in India, and that everything and anything goes on in India. Every kind of religion and cult and worship and praise. Such a rich and unpersecuted religion, a place where spirituality flowered in all sorts of ways over many thousands of years, and without persecution continued to flower side by side. So that was always an interesting lesson to see what goes on there. But having spent time, shall we say, with the Eastern wisdom and looked around elsewhere, I have nevertheless come to the conclusion, now this is after working with ritual for a long time, that all people at heart are, can be, should be, would be, must be pagan. In other words, yes, this is the root. You cannot avoid the root. Yes, you can go into the, you know, very high, beautiful, deep, otherworldly places, but those essentially end up being here and now. And the mystery of manifestation, the mystery of these grasses and winds and trees and the mystery of nature, the whole great intelligence that birth is, and us, and our words, and our stories, and our cultures, and our many crazy customs, and all the creativity that human beings have. It, the root of it is the soil and the sun and the water and the elements that we call in or praise or recognize or wish to once again remember and recall our relationship to, so that, you know, in ritual, prayerful cultures, there's always that wishing to return, and almost like to the mother or the ancestor, and yes, we remember where we come from. And so at this time of the crisis of the world, even more than ever, it would be so beautiful if people were to just, even with scientific knowledge, and even with super educated intellects, but more with the heart and more with your own body awareness, moment to moment body awareness, investigate from whence this world, from what did it arise, this impossible, inconceivable creation. Like, it's easy enough to get that if you're a meditator, for example, and you stick at it long enough to breathe in and out, you can eventually find a place that's quiet and blissful. And forgot to turn off my phone. Apologies, guys.
It's okay. It's a harp.
It's a pleasant enough harp, isn't it? Yeah. Well, that didn't turn it off either. What are we talking about? That you eventually can appreciate that there's love and bliss underneath everything. What is more difficult to explain is this manifestation. The other day I was watching the rain falling on an alder tree that I'd planted myself, and it's 25 years ago. It's grown nice and tall, and the wind was just gently scraping it back and over on the roof of an old truck that I'm not quite sure what to do with. It's in the backyard. And the metalness and the waterness and the leaves moving in the wind. It's like, that, where does that come from? And this wasn't a mystical place, you know. This is just an ordinary day in the backyard, sitting very quietly, and the whole mystery of it, metal and water and these soft leaves, you know, drinking the sunshine or whatever they do, the mystery of it. Who dreamt that up? Mm-hmm. I didn't dream that up. The cleverest human being on earth didn't dream that up. The most we could do is be in wonder of it, you know, just mm-hmm. when you get still enough and quiet enough. So I'm all for to address our situation or to find a way together to rediscover the pagan route, because certainly from anyone that's from my kind of cultural background, it was annihilated and wiped out, and it's got us into deep, deep trouble. And even when Christianity is the main myth of Europe, which has become for some reason the dominant culture worldwide, even when it abandoned that to some extent and took a more logical, intellectual approach, they ended up with science, which is wonderful, exploration through curiosity of the world. But it seemed to not tell us what to do. It just seemed to say, this seems to be how the world works. And all no matter how many amazing facts we know about the, you know, our 14 billion year old world, and that we're sitting in the middle of an explosion, and that somehow in that explosion there are lots of ice, and then there's one little planet that has water and millions of life forms teeming over one another. We all know about that, but we don't seem to have the way to feel it. Mm. We don't seem to have a way to honor it or be part of it or move with it or just be ecstatically happy about it. Now, planet Earth, it does have its trials, and there are the grief and tears of life. The struggles, and even if your house and your home are not troubled by war or religious strife, and even if your children do grow up to be happy and healthy, and I hope all yours do, still there are many things that, being human, you know, we're kind of anxious fools by nature, unable to really ride the bliss of things. But there, right there on in your backyard or in the park or in the, if you manage to find a patch in America, you probably can. Here is rare. A wild patch of land that no one has bothered with and just been left to have its own face and to breathe its own majesty. They're quite rare here. When you come across them, they're magnificent places. Bring us back thousands of years. But if you're lucky enough to be somewhere like that and to be still enough to not rush away and to be in your own body and for your own body to become the body of the world, and we start to sense that mystery, the original mother, the original father, the original ancestor, the original source of being. And without some reverence, without some deep reverential experience or being with or time alone with nature, with the elements in the raw, with somewhere that's been left to its natural burgeoning diversity, then we're not going to find our way. We're going to be living in an entirely human world, man-made world, after a while a machine-made world. And that's where we're heading now, enamored by these enormously sophisticated devices we've invented and making a new world for ourselves. But we're running out of metals, we're running out of magnets, we're running out of all the ingredients of our civilization, and it's not making anybody any happier, although it is making life easier. So, we were all, if we follow the route, we were all pagan once. We were all of the land, which is what the word means. Yeah. Mm-hmm. We were all born from the soil of this earth. We were all fed by plants, all fed by animals, all part of a huge, I nearly said ecstatic communion. It can seem like a big struggle, and it's portrayed as a struggle, but on the deeper levels, if we're prepared to explore our own consciousness and our own body, same thing, and then we get to the point where you realize it is an ecstatic communion. And that's over many years. I've run many camps, many like self-inquiry, meditation, Buddhist events. I've been involved in lots of different things. But the thing that I've sought for and is quite easily manifested, it didn't take too much searching for, was a basic root, regardless of what religion somebody professes or what background they have or whether they have no religion or whatever, that when we start to praise the earth, when we are in nature together, when the people are drawn together and an offering is made to fire or water or all those things brought together, everybody suddenly understands it. No one needs an explanation. People can get it very easily. And I usually say a few words on those occasions, but not many, as little as possible, but make people kneel or bow or use their body in some way, or have some sort of procession, or have some explosion of beauty, and just that the human beings sort of, this is great, we love being here, thank you water, thank you fire, in the simplest possible terms, you know. Well, there are more graceful and elegant ways of saying it and doing it than that. But if the people can be part of the floweriness, part of the ornament of earth, even just for a few moments, everyone seems to get it. Afterwards, there's an ecstatic kind of, the kids want to play, the lovers want to cuddle, the cooks want to make dinner, and everybody wants to eat and say something beautiful about everybody else. And then the next day, they'll start arguing again. But that brings into alignment. It's like, actually, it's magnificent being here. And if there's a little bit of natural water and woodland, here it's not water and woodland would be the natural thing. And, the joy of an evening. After a successful moment of ritual, and is that terrible word, successful, after a moment that somehow or other does bathe everybody in that touch of magic, then there is a emptiness and an ease and a willingness to kind of carry on and forgive and forget all the wrongs of the ins and outs of all the personalities that make up a community of people, and they're always going to be, you know, quite insane, but not incapable of reverence. So anyway, that's kind of no one needs to be converted to that, probably just listening to this program, that's saying that the pagan root's important. But to rediscover the pagan root, especially for people that are a little bit disenchanted by our civilization, maybe like I was as a teenager, I do not want to join in, but what else is there? If you wanted to really investigate it, you could borrow from another culture, which is not a bad idea, as long as you get their permission. That's not so easy, because if they got any sense, they won't give it to you. But one of the places to go looking is in the root stories, the old stories of our own culture, and possibly our neighbor's culture, and so forth. And luckily, those stories somehow or other managed to survive or hide out or not get wiped off the face of the earth like so many other beautiful things. Maybe because wherever people are, stories are, and wherever human culture is, there's a background story to it. And the interesting thing, I'll tell a little story about how it hit me, but it doesn't take too much to investigate and realize that the root stories are ancient, they're thousands of years old, and they're called fairy tales. That's their camouflage name. But they're not really fairy tales, they're earth tales or creation tales, water tales, how to live on earth tales. This is the big stuff. And so like in Western Europe, the Christian tale came along, the Christian story, and all of that terrible, intolerant history, which we don't go into now, pushed aside a much greener, more ancient, earth-loving and very majestic tradition. And you can still smell it a little bit in somewhere in the dusty pages of Grimm's fairy tales, and you can smell it a bit more in the Russian fairy tales and the odd story from Hungary or Romania or all over the place. There you'll especially if you're lucky enough to come across stories that haven't been destroyed, that have been kept alive by a real culture that loves its stories and knows that the big story of life needs to be kept alive and respected. And if you can only find that in a pagan culture. You can find it in a culture that says we want to move away from earth and go somewhere better, but in people that are rooted in their place, then there's a kind of a magic story. And I don't have many theories about this. I don't want to talk theory. I don't want it to be like a university lecture about stories or anything like that. But just the joy of discovering things, that I come to the idea that there's only one big story, and you see it told in different ways from place to place. And in countries like ours, cultures like ours, where things are broken up, you're just going to find little bits and pieces of it. In other places, you might find the more fulsome, magnificent versions. But my son at the moment is traveling, my 18-year-old, I've got three sons, is traveling in the Northern Territories in Australia. And I said, well, see if you can hang out with some of the original people if you get a chance, you know. And then I asked him, how's it going? And he said, yeah, he's talking to me, so most of them seem to be like drunk in the street. I said, no, there's still people living in the jungle, and there's still people doing the old ways, and they still got their stories. And if you get a chance, you should sit with them and pay some respect. And he said, they stay very, very far away from the white man.
Oh, yeah.
And I said, yeah, I don't blame them. And he said, no, neither do I. You know, and he's seen what, in the short time he's been traveling there, seen what's going on in Australia. So I wouldn't expect any of the original people to be in a hurry to share the magnificence of their traditions, but there is still a chance for people to learn from them. And even in our own dusty books, no thanks to Walt Disney and all those bits, the stories are unkillable. So they're hanging out somewhere. And I found in my own little adventure that if you could find one in a book somewhere that hasn't been told for a while, the story starts to like you. And then after a while, you're not quite sure if the story found you or if you found the story. The same way with a piece of land. Mm. And I was the ground we're sitting on here was where my father was born, and his father, and his father, and his father. I would never have chosen to live in these flat fields near the main road, but maybe it chose me. And the same way that when I first went looking for a place to put our teepees up, that land appeared in a spirit horse that we were traveling in before, where we did our last talk. Don't know why things happen the way they happen. It's one of the most mysterious, mystical adventures is to go into the world of story. And for that, people need to reopen and get back into their oral traditions. So I'll go back to the beginning of this in a moment, but I worked with many people for years with story. One of the kind of tribal traditions, or if you like, or one of the qualifications to go a little bit deeper into what it is to be part of the spirit horse scene, is that everybody has to learn to tell a traditional story by heart, word for word.
Oh, really?
And you have to find the story yourself somewhere, probably a story that's lost, and like not to have it told by, you know, by some beautiful retelling that's been done already or already printed and made famous in Women Who Run With the Wolves or something better. Go and find a story that's been ignored, that no one's told for like 1,000 years, which is, there's plenty of them. They might have been recorded and, you know, passed down, but find something that looks like it might be looking for you. And a lot of people agonize over this, so, you know, go to the libraries or whatever and search around. I mean, the internet changes everything, but better to, you know, put some effort in that way. Find one line in the story that sounds really beautiful to you. If one line in the story jumps up, that's the hook. That means there might be something in there for you. And if there's two lines in the story, that's going to be the one. And you don't have to understand what the story's about, or even the culture it comes from. But if it's somehow saying, yeah, go on, tell me in English, because it's probably in translation, obviously. English is the kind of crazy way forward, a very bendable, big vocabulary words. So it's possible to tell stories from different cultures in English, even though they might be half destroyed by that, but they can half live as well. And if it's a real story, it's going to be kind of strong enough to somehow make it through. But that's something that came later on in the spirit horse experiment, which ended up being a kind of, how do we start a new culture? But if you don't mind, I'll backtrack to London 3 or 4 years before I started the whole spirit horse adventure. So I was in my late 20s, and I went along quite lightheartedly to this gig with Robin Williamson, who is a fantastic harpist and master storyteller, although he's very comedic and entertaining and a very light touch, but tells lots of Celtic stories with the harp. This is Williamson. Some of the old hippie people might remember that the Incredible String Band from the 60s. So he was half of that, you know. Oh, and then when that era was over, which I see in his own words, I went straight through the middle of the 60s. And they were a kind of incredible band, you know, that did have all these strange instruments and really flowery lyrics and obviously quite a mystical psychedelic background to them. But anyway, he went on to study the harp pretty seriously and tell stories with the harp. But I was hit like by a freight train. You know, it was at the Royal Festival Hall or somewhere like that by the Thames, the big concrete building. But there was this man making quite a jokey rendition of several Celtic stories, but telling it to the harp. And every now and again, it would drop down to something that was so soulful. And just the voice and the harp, it just awakened something in the body. It was like a physical experience, like, oh my God, what is this? This is something incredible. Forgive me if I say the story, I'm telling it a few times. I've got a feeling I've told this story to someone else recently. Oh, it wasn't you, or your listeners. I don't want to bore them with the same story, but there was afterwards, I was kind of shaking. I mean, it was a lighthearted touch. It wasn't like shamanic storytelling, but it had done something to me. My belly wasn't the same, my back wasn't the same. And that was back in the days of tape, before CDs had been invented and all that. And there was a few things for sale, and I looked at them. I thought, yeah, these Celtic tales, oh yeah, tales of prodigies and marvels, humorous tales from the west of Scotland, and tales from Ireland. And I thought, I should buy one. And I thought, no, buy a little five set. And there was about, I think he had about 50 tapes at the time. And then my friend that I was with has since gone to heaven, but I think it's okay to say his name. He's been dead a while now. It's called Clive Goodenough. He leaned over my shoulder, and I said, look at all this stuff. This is really good. I'm really interested. And he said, just buy the whole lot. And it was going to be like, you know, 2 weeks' wages to do that. And I said, damn, you're right. So I bought all the tapes that were there, and then took them home, and then I worked through them one by one. That was my apprenticeship in storytelling. I just wanted to learn them all. I listened to them all over and over again. I didn't learn every single one of them by heart, but I learned quite a lot. And I thought, well, where else are there stories? Are there more where this came from? And that's when I started to look through Grimm's fairy tales with fresh eyes, you know, like, we all hear this stuff in childhood. And then I discovered there are these amazing treasures in there. And then I started looking in the middle of a ritual at one point. Something just hit me on the head and said, you have to go back to Ireland. When you go back to Galway, you have to go into all the old bookshops. Bookshops were still important in those days. You know, you couldn't find everything on the net. I don't know if there was even a net then. But anyway, I went back and started buying some of these old out-of-print books that I'd even heard my aunt talking about, that they used to be school books when they were kids. But anyway, anywhere I could find the old stories, and I didn't know where to go. I left school at 16, so I didn't have any research skills, you know. But it didn't take too long. And talking to other storytellers to find out the oldest text you could find translated from the Irish about 120 years ago, when Irish language was discovered, not to be this throwaway. That's just what the milkmaids speak, which is what the British Empire thought it was, and there actually was this huge body of literature, the bits the Vikings didn't burn, that were a direct route back to like centuries and centuries before, through at least to one or maybe two of the golden ages that Ireland's seen. The present era is not a golden age. But going back to that time when the saints and scholars, and there were plenty of them, recorded everything of the pagan past, but they put it in some kind of, with a little Christian bracket at the beginning and end, you know. And Patrick blessed them all. And you get these vast stories that go on for page after page after page. They're topographical, a lot of them, like Aboriginal stories are. Not that I'm an expert on those either, but you hear about these stories walking through the land at this mountain and hill. And it seems like when you get down to the old real root pagan stories, they have that. They're connected to the place. They're connected to the place, but they are also connected to the eternal story. And it's like this beautiful marriage. So these stories can be quite boring to get through until you like develop a taste for them. You know, it's like getting to enjoy top quality whiskey. You have to work at it a little bit. And so this adventure began for me personally, of looking to find the source that I would recognize in my own culture and in other people's culture. Yeah, sorry, am I talking too fast?
No, it's beautiful. So please,
Yes. Into it. So like in those, this was in the early days, I'm talking about a thing called Spirit Horse, which is an experiment that started 30 years ago. I did not know where it's going, but now that we can look over our shoulder, it would turn out to be an adventure that involved setting up initially a small summer camp in a wild valley at the back end of a farm, basically in Wales, and ended up being us creating our own preserve and many, many people clubbing together to buy 200 acres of land and build Celtic roundhouses and basically create the kind of the eternal village, or at least a sort of a fragment, a glimpse into it, a place with no electricity, with no piped water and so forth, a thing that did not pander to anybody's I want my modern comfort zone, I want to come and live the kind of teepee life in Wales, which is a ridiculous thing to attempt, but we tried it anyway. Or later on, we sort of build ourselves temples and saunas and more solid structures that look more like Celtic roundhouses. But anyway, the thing was to experiment with these things, that the pagan route, the stories, how to rediscover ritual, and also to do the deep self-inquiry, and also to have our Buddhist friends come along and teach and run retreats and so forth. Anything, as long as people are prepared to do it in an open field or in the glade of a forest, and to stay very, very close to nature and the raw. And I just wanted to do that, but lo and behold, many other people wanted to do it too. So, you know, it took on a life of its own. All of a sudden, I had a very, very, very busy life. I'm trying to slow down now. So that's just the context of what I'm referring to. That there was every summer several months of play where I would introduce stories, and the stories would feed into the rituals we were doing. We're trying to reinvent that too. I just got fascinated by it after I went off for a weekend to do some kind of strange kind of rituals. I thought, well, there's something here all the same. So these two things went side by side with me in a kind of wild experiment, and I found that other people could go along with it, and that if we told the stories about the old Celtic heroes, we could work an extra 4 hours a day. And it wasn't a productivity drive, it was just the spirit of things got a hold of us. There's almost like the god somewhere or other, or some wild part of the great intelligence said, so down there in that wild valley, there's a bunch of guys, and later the women showed up, and it got a little bit more comfortable, and they're living next to a raw fire, they're cooking on it, and they're living next to the water, they're singing to the water, they've got their teepees and their yurts up, and they're, you know, it's almost like something said, yeah, go ahead, give it a go, and maybe that was, there was something in the air, we'd feel it moving, almost like the fairy realm came that bit nearer. I'd often say something or have a moment with the people and think, something's moved in the she, something's moved in the other world. We're deeper in here than we were before. And then you'd know what to do in the next ritual, or know what to do when the men and women wanted to say things to each other, or you know how to create a men's lodge, women's lodge vibe. And then we ended up creating men's lodge over there, women's lodge over there, sacred spaces. We somehow got the knack of remaking these things and it required a lot of, no logic, a lot of panache and boldness and extravagance, and things being acted out and embodied. Mm-hmm. When she finds out who she is, she embodies it. When he finds out who he is, he praises it. That's why men have to be poets, and that's why so many women are called to be dancers. And that's why so many men work hard to learn to play the instruments. And the ones that succeed will call the women back to dance the world alive again. And it's kind of live a bit of ritual, to, you know, if you've been around a while, enough sacred space to see these simple things that come alive. Mm-hmm. And men have to tell the stories, and so do women. There's some things that men have to do, and if they get it right, it feeds into what women can do. And if that happens, then everything gets fed. And it's like simple little things like that, the play between male and female energies when you're living in a tribal, communal, ritual way. Now, don't get me wrong, most of the time you have to get on with things. You know, you have to fix what got wet and mend the roof and build the next one and all that. But there has to be time set aside where we're purely in ritual, when the most thing that seems to need to happen is just to praise everything, you know. Praise female, male, in the world, in the clouds, in the water, in the trees, in the earth, in the rocks. And that takes a long time when you want to do it properly. It has to be done with a lot of style and panache. But, and we found, anyway, the more we got into that, the more arrived. But the stories had that panache in them. It's not similar to what's the meaning of the story or the Jungians, you know, compared to your dreams or look for archetypes. We never bothered any of that stuff. And I still don't. I'm still like, what's the word? More like a slave of the story. Like they just get hold of me from time to time and I just have to tell them. And then whatever happens in the telling happens without interpretation. But somehow the majesty, the panache, or the depth, or the tenderness, or the boldness, or the strength, or the vitality of the ancient world came through those stories, like you make a portal or a channel, without saying we're going to make a portal and a channel. Just telling the stories of the body would rearrange itself, especially if you tell stories in a ritual place, and especially if you take off the t-shirts and the jeans and all that crap that people wear these days and start to, you know, look a bit more magnificent and then tell the stories and then act something, give something to the story, you know, like make an offering with your body, with your hands, with your speech, with the way you throw your weight around. And when men and women do that together without fighting, or if they're going to have a fight, have a really good fight, then things start to get kind of juicy and nice, and then everything wants to live, everything wants to breathe easy, and you do not have to be, unlike later religions, it's the vitality and the juiciness that we're interested in, the willingness to engage with life and the willingness to weep over its, when it's time for weeping, when the grief is there and the sadness is there, and not to shun it away and not to try to be happy all the time, or not to find an answer to life or a solution or some permanence, you know, one day we'll all be okay, but to just the sheer joy of living. And by the way, if people do want to create communities like this, I do have one little bit of advice. No one asked me for any, but there you go. That people first of all have to learn to weep together. Mm-hmm. They'd have to grieve over things rather than have some joyous vision about how fantastic it's all going to be when we all get together and live heaven on earth. You ain't going to get together and live heaven on earth. It ain't going to be like that. But it is already like that if you can deeply accept the dark and light, up and down. And very, very beautiful when people can cry over things and experience loss together. That would be something. And get rid of the success story. Like we've got, that's the business story now. Like, be successful, be better, be more. Don't bother. Be as is. The miracle has already happened, or as Nisargadatta said, the explosion has already occurred. Those stars, 14 billion or 13.8, whatever it is, billion, that explosion happened. The mind of God has already exploded. As one young man said to me coming out of a ritual, I went, wow. So, in fact, he said it to everyone. That the mind of God has already exploded. We're already in the miracle. I think that's one of the beautiful things about the pagan thing, is like to celebrate this, call it earth, fire, water, and air, but this magnificent combination, this magnificent, endlessly diverse creation. Nobody understands how it works, but we all know we're in it, and there has to be a better place involved. This is already utterly miraculous, mm-hmm. And the more you go into the contemplation of it, the more blissful you become, and the more you want it to be different and better, the more busy you get and miss the whole show. It's okay to be busy. It's okay to want things. But yeah, the stillness time matters too. So just go back to this story thing. I was hammering away with this because like people go, oh, tell us more of them stories. So I had to go and learn more of them. And that was my duty. And they had the stories, wanted to be paid tax. At first I read a couple and then I realized, no, you're going to have to learn the story word for word. You found a nice version of it. No, one of the first stories was the story of Oisín and Tír na n-Og, which some people have said they've seen recently. That's the one we did on the harp, with Imre Leinen playing the harp, and I thought it's time to tell that story properly with the harp. Had quite a few attempts at it.
I saw it. It was beautiful.
Yeah, so like that story has bothered me for 30 years. You know, like I've been telling it over and over. It's a really simple story. You think you get bored with it, but I wouldn't even say it's one of the really ancient stories. You know, but it's got something. And I can't tell you what it is. It just every now and again, it has to be told. And just when I think, well, I've told that one enough, I don't need to tell it again, someone will say, could you please tell us the story You know, and which one? That one. The one about the horse and the maiden and the young warrior. It's that. And then people want me to tell it to their kids. So I know that the story can't be killed. If I don't tell it, somebody else will. No, the stories appeared that wanted to be told somehow. We needed a story from over here, we needed a story from over there. And there were stories that had that Celtic panache in. And then there were other stories, particularly a couple of stories from North America, from the indigenous people, that just came my way, and I couldn't stop telling them the beauty and the intelligence of them. And there are other stories that didn't have the poetry so much, didn't have the wordiness, the flowery language or the depth of language that I looked for, because they'd been told translated from one Native American language to another or whatever, or else been told in Pidgin English or something like that. But even so, the way that they were had first been transmitted, somebody had faithfully written them down and get retold, they were too. And all of a sudden you could contact the spirit of bear. That was one of the big stories that came along, or the spirit of the forest. And I got totally in love with a very simple version. It's from somewhere around the northeast coast of America, version of Cinderella. And that wouldn't stop being told for a while, until after a while I had a band playing drums and synthesizers and all the rest. We wanted to get it so like just right. That became our hit single for a while. And I fell in love with those stories, and I thought, well, if there's these few stories have come my way, there must be more. And I went on like that for quite some time, and I discovered the Russian fairy tales, and they were really magnificent. And then something really strange and utterly unforeseen happened, that a shaman appeared in the UK, being introduced to the English audience by Robert Bly, who'd done a lot of work on stories and was doing a pretty good job there of kind of waking people up. But he introduced this guy called Martin Prechtel, and when I heard him tell a story, and when I heard the language that the people from his culture, his village, spoke, and the way they did, you know, this, even just the perfume of how they did ritual, I nearly fell over. It's like, what is this? Is the real thing? This is not me searching through Celtic origins, romantic as all that sounds. It's quite a hack, really. This, you know, no living being. People think the Druids are still alive in Ireland. I don't think they are. Excuse me out there if anyone knows them, that's fine. But I've lived here and lived long, and I haven't come across anything like the living tradition. And to, you know, when you really experience living masters from any tradition, from Tibet or wherever, or shamans wherever, who have been blessed by teachers who themselves were living legends, those people are, you know, that's when you have to bend the knee and touch the ground and say, please show me something if you can be bothered. And you realize what a fool you are. So along came this magnificent shaman who had some of the big stories that hadn't been broken and wrecked and destroyed. So I was like, wow, these were 7 years into the Spirit Horse experiment, and someone has shown up who really knows. So I just kind of wanted to drink from that well as much as possible. And then everything got reaffirmed. If you want to try to find the root again, if you want to find out where the civilization's gone wrong, if you want to attempt to return to a holy way of life, which is not necessarily a sanctimonious way of life, just a connected, deep, undestroying, life-giving way of life, you have to look at which stories are you telling yourself, which stories are you running away from, which stories do you need to embrace, which stories got it wrong. And I was like, okay, so we can carry on.
We have 15 minutes left.
Ah, my goodness, the time flies by and there's so much to say. Yeah, okay. We could then maybe have a little story. Let me just round off that strain of thought. Yeah, let's say a little bit of something, like, not to get too complex, but that search for the root stories served me well, it served the people around me well, it did serve to help to make community, and I think it may be the place to look. And of course, when you go back to those old fairy tales, there is a reverence for nature, animals, and our original wild selves. So I had a really great friend and fellow researcher and storyteller. We both kind of went to the holy places and the mountains where poetry can be found, They're still in the legends there, what to do. Chris Jones is his name. I haven't seen him for a while now. His arthritis is playing up and things like that. He's getting on like myself. But together we did quite a bit of research. And lots of other people too. I haven't forgotten anybody. Or I try not to. But he had much more time to read and study than me. He lives in a library full of books. And we were talking about stories. And I said, well, you know, what about Cinderella? There's this version over here and that version. He said, yeah, you can't find a culture that hasn't got a version of it. Now, he might not be right, and maybe there is some culture somewhere that hasn't got a version of it, but you can find a version of it in all the continents. You can find it north and south and east and west. The story of Cinderella, which everyone thinks they know, and they do in their bones, but you've probably encountered it in some rather, made silly version.
Disney fashion.
Disney fashion, yeah. I mean, not even the superpowers of Disney can destroy the real stories. They're there somewhere. And if you are at all drawn to it, I recommend you dig up some of the old Russian stories. You can't tell one of them here. I'm just telling Sunshine that, you know, she said, we got an hour. And I said, yeah, but the stories I want to tell are an hour and a quarter. So. And for fear of losing you when I can't see who's falling asleep, I can't do one of those. But so many of the Russian stories are like triple Cinderellas. I think of them as there's Cinderella three times over going on. You got someone walking down the corridor there. Beautiful to see these magnificent versions of the Cinderella theme. But one way or another, all over the world, I will like to tell a short one, the short version that comes from the original Americas. Wherever it is, there's a young girl. She's the youngest of three sisters. The mother, for one reason or another, is not present. The father, for one reason or another, doesn't really know what's going on. How unusual does that sound? Or he's not, you know, he's not connected to what's happening. He's kind of passive there. And she's the rejected one. She's in one way or another, she's a social misfit, or she hasn't got the right clothes, doesn't say the right things. She's been pushed into a kind of shabby place and a shabby role. But it always turns out that she's a real thing. When it comes to the marriage, when it comes to the communion, when it comes to the magnificent moment, she has got that wild quality preserved in her that allows her to meet the world, to really meet the world with the fullness of her being. And the other sisters are socially conditioned. They get invited to the right parties, they got the right clothes, they drive the right cars, they got their careers worked out, or something like that. Okay, I think that's enough little background. I'd like to tell you the first version that found me and started to bother me. It's about a girl called Uchigiskoa. In the ancient days, there was once a large village of the Mi'kmaq Indians of the eastern Algonquin, built on the shores of a lake. And at the far end of the lake, there was a birch bark lodge. And in it lived a being who was always invisible. He lived there with his sister. She could see him, of course, but nobody else could. Now, it was well known in that village that any girl who was able to see him might marry him. And for that reason, there were not many girls in the village who at some point or other did not try their luck. If they wished to try, they would go down in the evening when the sky was turning black. And there they would meet with the sister of the invisible one. And there they would walk and talk. And when that noble lady saw her brother returning from his day, she would ask, "Can you see him?" This is how the test of sight was carried out. She would ask questions. The girls nearly always replied yes, chancing their luck. But when asked what his shoulder strap was made of, or with what did he draw his sledge, They would answer, "Why, a strip of rawhide." Whether they were lying or guessing, nevertheless, they'd be invited back to the lodge to help prepare supper. And there they would wait for the invisible one to enter. They could be sure he was a real person, because when his sister took off his moccasins, the moccasins became visible. But if they saw that, that was all they saw, even if they stayed there all night long. And they would be told not to sit in the seat near the door, which is the wife's seat. Now it so happened, as everybody knows, that there was a man in that village whose wife had died, and he lived in the lodge with his three daughters. The eldest was strong-willed and haughty. The youngest was weak, often sick. Nevertheless, she was made to do all the work by the older sisters, especially the eldest, who slapped her, hit her, sometimes even beat her with a stick, told her to mind her work, to fetch the water, to light the fire, to carry the ashes. Always the ashes. Sometimes, in a fit of temper, she would even strike the girl with a hot stick from the fire. And the poor creature was so marked on her hands and feet and even her face from this cruel treatment that she was known as Uchigiasqua, the rough-faced girl. When her father came home from his day, he would ask, "What's happened to this girl? Why these marks? She will not mind her tasks. She'll do nothing around the house," the eldest one would retort. Time passed, as it always does. And a day came when the two sisters decided they would try their luck at seeing the invisible one. They dressed up in their finest, they put on their jewels, and they went down in the evening to walk and talk with the sister of the invisible one. When they were asked if they could see him, they replied, "Oh, yes, of course." And when they were asked about the shoulder strap or about the sledge, they replied, "Oh, flexible green branches twisted together." But they were lying, and they got nothing for their trouble. Shortly after that, the father came home with some of the pretty little shells that are used to make wampum decoration. He shared them out among the girls, well, among the elders too. And the middle sister gave a small handful to Uchigiasqua, and all the girls set to work to grind them and shape them and drill holes in them and to make them into necklaces. Not long after that, Uchigiasqua, who had always gone barefoot, took a pair of her father's moccasins, soaked them in a birch bark bucket of water to try and make them fit her own feet. And the day after that, she went off with a knife into the forest, and there she cut for herself strips of birch bark, and she made for herself a new set of clothes and decorated them in the style of long ago. She made for herself a gown and a headdress and leggings, and she burnt marks into them in the ancient way. And then the day after that, wearing those moccasins that didn't fit her and wearing her ancient birch bark clothes, she announced that she was going to try her luck at seeing the invisible one. And she was told to stay at home and mind her work. And as she set off, she didn't set off very well. The shoes didn't fit and the clothes were hanging loose. And as she walked through the village, the loafers hanging around the village called out, "Shame, shame, shame." Nevertheless, she was very well received by the sister of the invisible one when she arrived in the evening at the shore of the lake. For this noble lady knew far more about the nature of things than can be seen from the outside, which all the world knows. Together they walked, and there they talked, and when the blue of the evening sky was turning black, the lady turned to Uchigiasqua and asked, "Can you see my brother?" She replied, "Yes, I can, and he is beautiful." Of what, said the lady, is his shoulder strap made? It's made, she said, of the rainbow. Of what, said the lady, is his bowstring made? She said, it's made of the Milky Way. It's made of the stars. So you can see, my brother. Yes, he said. Very well. Let us return to the lodge. And when they arrived there, the lady prepared a bath for Uchigiesqua. And then she bathed her. And as she did, the marks fell from her face and from her hands and from her feet. And then the lady took a comb, and she combed the hair of Uchigiesqua, so that it grew again, long and black, until it shone like a raven's wing. And then, from her treasures, the lady brought a wedding garment and put that dress on Uchigiesqua. Her eyes were now like stars, and in all the world there was no other such beauty. And then she was told to sit and wait in the wife's seat, in the seat next to the door, until he would come. And when he entered, terrible and beautiful, he looked and he smiled, and he said, so, we are found out. Yes, said his sister, we are found out. And Uchigiesqua became his wife. Became his wife.
Mm. There you go. Thank you, Shivam.
Were we just inside the time limit, or how do we go?
We have 2 minutes.
Ah, good.
Can you tell our listeners how they can find you, your stories, YouTube, and all that good stuff?
Yeah, okay. Well, I've just got a note from the girl who looks after the webpage that our website is down, so I was going to get it back up. So spirithorse.co.uk, if you could hang on a couple of days, folks, if you fancy checking that out. That's got nearly everything on, and hopefully if this... viral nonsense that's going around the world ever ends, then we can go back to our camp next summer in Wales.
Yes.
In the middle of the mountains there, in this beautiful place with the waterfalls and forest and the land that we're all letting go wild. Our village is placed, and we run a whole series of things that we welcome all guests to, you know, we come with a little bit of respect to come and help make it happen and partake of it. spirithorse.co.uk. There is a Facebook page. It hasn't been, I'm not great on the internet, and we haven't done that much this year. There's also, for people into deep self-inquiry and more serious retreats, which are not necessarily of pagan origin, but have no particular religion, but for people who want to inquire into their own being, I run a few retreats every year, and there's a website dedicated to that called authenticself.co.uk, which is up and running to the best of my knowledge. And that'll pretty much find us, and you can send me a note through that, anyone who wants to make contact. And nice to meet you all in this wild way. I hope the world becomes a little bit more sane next year, and we can sit around our fires together. And I hope your families and your mountains and your forests and your back gardens and your backyards are flowering and burgeoning, and you're not cooped up somewhere that's too awkward, and that we can all be meet our tribal associates next year and hang out together. Blessings to everyone.
Blessed be. Thank you, Shivam.
Thank you, Sunshine. Thanks for the opportunity. Nice to talk.
This has been The Pagan Perspective. Happy equinox and bright, balanced blessings to you all. Much love till we meet again.
Strength in the center of my soul. You bless me with your strength. Oh, holy child, you bless me with your love. Oh, holy child, you bless me with your love. In the center of my soul, you bless me with your love. In the center of my soul, you bless me with your love. Oh, glorious Father, you bless me with your light. Oh, glorious Father, you bless me with your light. In the center of my soul, you bless me with your light. In the center of my soul, you bless me with your light. Oh, sacred mother, you bless me with your strength. Oh, sacred mother, you bless me with your strength. In the center of my soul, you bless me with your strength. In the center of my soul, bless me with your strength. Oh, holy child, you bless me with your love. Oh, holy child, you bless me with your love. In the center of my soul, you bless me with your love. In the center of my soul, me with your love. Oh, glorious Father, you bless me with your light. Oh, glorious Father, you bless me with your light. In the center of my soul, you bless me with your light. In the center of my soul, you bless me with your light. Oh, sacred mother, you bless me with your strength. Oh, sacred mother, you bless me with your strength. In the center of my soul, you bless me with your strength. In the center of my soul, you bless me with your strength. Oh, holy child, you bless me with your light. Oh, holy child, you bless me with your light. In the center of my soul, you bless me with your light. In the center of my soul, you bless me with your love. Oh, glorious Father, you bless me with your light. Oh, glorious Father, you bless me with your light. In the center of my soul, you bless me with your light. In the center of my soul, you bless me with your light. Oh, sacred mother, you bless me with your strength. Oh, sacred mother, you bless me with your strength. In the center of my soul, you bless me with your strength. In the center of my soul, you bless me with your strength. Oh, holy child, you bless me with your light. Oh, holy child, you bless me with your light. In the center of my soul, you bless me with your love. In the center of my me with your love. In the center of my soul, you bless me with your love. In the center of my soul, you bless me with your love.